I'm Monica Eileen Patterson with the Center for Ethnographic Research and Exhibition in the Aftermath of Violence at Concordia University, and I'm here today to speak with Joy Sather Wagstaff about her newly released book, Heritage That Hurts, Tourists in the Memoryscapes of September 11th, and about some of her ongoing work and research. We're very happy to have you here for our public history lecture. And I thought that I would just speak to you a little about the research that went into the making of your book mm-hmm. and some of the future directions that you're pursuing. One of the main contributions I think you make is to the field of tourist studies and tourism studies. So I thought I'd start by just asking you why anthropologists, historians, museum practitioners, and others care about tourism and visitor studies?
Well, I think it has to do with, well, particularly if you're thinking about various kinds of public history institutions and museums and such, is you really consider who goes there. It's largely people who would be classified as tourists, so those who are in from out of town, often staying overnight. Local regional areas. We do a lot of regional development in North Dakota, and you know, maybe 10% of the people who visit those institutions are locals. The other 90% are actually tourists. So I think it's very significant to understand them as a particular kind of audience, a particular kind of visitor, and pay very close attention to what they do. Because even though they may never revisit your institution or revisit your site, it's important because one of the things that tourists tend to do, and I imagine the old 1970s slideshows that people would give of their vacations, is they talk about where they've been. And so a wonderful experience, a good experience, a positive experience, a powerful experience is something they'll share with people, and that, you know, turns back upon the institution in terms of influencing future visitation. And they are very unique too because of that very mobility. They're fleeting, they're widely dispersed, especially for any sites that are popular for international tourism, and so they're a challenge to study.
One of the innovations I think that you offer is in your methodological approach of studying tourists, and I was really struck by the importance that became so clear in your writing of extending the field site beyond just the site of memory. So for instance, in your field work as an anthropologist, you continued contact with some of your subjects. You went to visit them beyond the sites of your first encounter. How do you think that broadening the field site helped you to understand tourists more?
Well, I think one thing is a temporal dimension. It's not just a sort of spatial dimension, but if I'm really wanting to know what are the social effects, the transformative effects, the identity effects of travel, those don't just happen at the moment of that travel experience. They are constantly sort of renegotiated over time in the context of additional life experiences. And people tend to recollect the memories of their experiences in those new contexts over time. So a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, what they remember often changes. Different things become important about their experience. And their own changing personal and political contexts also influence how they think back on something. And so being able to talk to someone, you know, 10 years after they've been to a place, and to hear what they recall as being powerful or important or extremely pleasurable or memorable really tells me something about that particular experience as they've sort of carried it with them and transformed it over time. If you kind of just focus on the visit time itself, you know, when they're right there sort of in the experience or just after the experience, you do have that sort of just immediate response, right? Which isn't often what the lasting response is. And so to be able to sort of track that transformation is very important. And I think particularly with the sites that I study, which have a certain very important social justice salience and a certain political salience, that to see how subjectivities can change over time as a result of being at a site and then reflecting on it and recollecting those memories over time, how that changes, also tells me something about the transformative power of travel and visiting these places.
And can you see any patterns or general trends in the transformations and shifts that occur?
I think probably the clearest trend is very much specific to, for instance, the 9/11 work, in that if you track over the time between 2001 and now in 2011, and you look at this shifting context, for instance, of what has been going on in terms of the Middle East, what has been going on in terms of this new war or sets of wars, that people do reflect upon their experience at, say, the former site of the World Trade Center or the Tribute Center or the Memorial Landscape in the context of these new things going on. And it doesn't have any sort of one particular kind of outcome, but as they reflect back on what they saw, they recontextualize it in terms of this sort of shifting political context. And that's something that didn't necessarily surprise me, but to consider sort of how marked it has been, marked with the anniversaries of 9/11, as well as I thought to myself as I went back this year for the anniversary, what would have happened if Osama bin Laden had not been captured and killed? How would have that changed the tenor of that particular set of anniversary events, as well as the people who were participating in those? I don't have any conclusions for that, but it's sort of one what-if context situation.
It seems that one of the goals of your book is to rescue tourists in a certain way from the stereotypical, demeaning, and homogenizing caricatures that most scholars have used in their attempts to present them. But are all tourists equal? And are there some useful lines of critique that should be maintained in studies of tourists?
I think no differently than studies of any part of humanity. I always sort of joke around with people that, we can find rude, boorish, racist, whatever, people anywhere. I mean, we can find them in the grocery store. We can find them, in our classrooms, anywhere. When they're mobile as travelers, it's sort of no different. The problem I have with sort of the characterizing all tourists as sort of engaging in sort of meaningless behavior is really much based on some very romantic notions that kind of say that consumptive behavior is somehow meaningless. And here, when I listen to people talk about their travels, and this has nothing to do with their sort of personalities or their actual behaviors when they're in a place, when I hear them talk about their travels and they talk about them as being very important and being a marker of time, it's interesting how people will often track time by, the places that they've been. That's one of the things that I want to take, to have people take very seriously, because these are very meaningful to individual identities and really tracking one's sort of life cycle. I acknowledge it, and honestly, many of the people that I often had very long and passionate conversations with, I disagreed with heartily. I did not necessarily like them as people, but as an anthropologist, one of the things I'm bound to do is to take them very seriously. So I find that in some of the literature that sort of demeans tourists and tourism, they're not taking people seriously.
What do you mean by consumption?
Consumption in a number of ways, but primarily in terms of anything that's a dollar exchange, anything that's a commodified activity. And as we know, travel, you need money to do that. Almost every aspect of going someplace requires income. And whether you're going on a guided tour for pay, or you're just managing to get someplace and then you can live on the cheap, regardless, you're engaged in acts of consumption. And this is a particular kind of tension when we get into sites and institutions that are for this heritage that hurts, that are for these tragic and painful moments or processual events in human history, that very dark side of human history, because there's a tendency to sort of sacralize that in a way, and the sacred is very much held in opposition to, you know, the profane, of course. And in the eyes of a lot of scholars who are very critical of consumption and commodification in any means, that suddenly makes the sacred profane. So even sort of whiff of any sort of consumer accommodation really taints, in their eyes, these sorts of sites. Where, on the other hand, I argue, well, if you had not actually, let's say, provided restrooms at Auschwitz, how amenable would it be to people going there and spending time there and having the very powerful experiences we know that they have there? And so there's an element where some of these things are absolutely sort of necessary. They're not denigrating or desacralizing, profaning a particular site. If you didn't have them, people wouldn't go. And then how powerful would that site be if no one visited?
The injunction of never again is at the heart of many memorial sites, and yet large-scale crimes against humanity continue. Can exhibits help, and how?
I think that they can, at least in the results of my research. I've seen an awful lot of personal transformation on a very sort of small scale that I think can have a positive impact. And I find it difficult because there's this notion that we want to do something really great and huge and large scale to make sure that these things don't happen. On the other hand, I think it's sort of the very basic everyday life, what people do, how they think, how they act, that really can have a bigger effect than something that's sort of large scale in a sort of top-down way. I do believe that educating people on what happened is very important, but the problem is, what do they take away for, you know, in a really powerful way? What do they internalize? And maybe they have an experience that doesn't impact them right away. I look at some of my students who have been to, for instance, been to the former site of the World Trade Center or been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. while they were, you know, youths, they were teens. And it's not until they're in their 20s and they're back in a classroom and they're talking about these places or they're getting some other historical context that they suddenly realize the impact that that visit has had on them as a person. And they start to sort of deconstruct it in a way that if you'd asked them when they were 13 years old, they wouldn't have been able to tell you what that impact was. And so I look at it as something, again, it adds that sort of temporal dimension. On the other hand, clearly we're not making much progress because we do see the repetition of these acts and of violence. And I do think that it requires a larger action on the part of large groups of people, and the persistence of these institutions of saying we must maintain, you know, we must be here, and in addition, we must grow to address the broader context in terms of the things that begin to happen in the future.
Do you think tourists have the power to change the content and form of more institutionalized museum and memorial sites?
In terms of the museum content, I'm not sure if necessarily they always have an interest in doing that, but they do actively emplace their own knowledge when they're having an experience in the museum. If they find that they think that something's missing, but they don't often feel they have the authority to go and say this is missing and to, you know, to register some sort of complaint. Although I've seen that in a few cases. I mean, this is something you would think about participatory museums that do depend upon building content with visitors. That's one dimension to this. On the other hand, those that have this sort of primarily educative mission do like to provide a fairly accessible narrative, which often does have some silences in terms of certain information. I think in particular, we're thinking about memorial landscapes, they do play a much more active role, and that's because of the sort of, should we say, the culture of these makeshift memorials that has now persisted and become something that's very characteristic of even memorial spaces once they're formalized. And this actually, there's a tension there because some of these spaces, in terms of the way they're designed and the designers and the caretakers see them as being, once they're sort of formalized with the formal built environment landscape, that kind of vernacular commemorative activity doesn't belong there. It doesn't belong aesthetically in that space. But in terms of a practice, that's something that's very important for people who visit to feel as though they've left something there as a part of themselves, sort of marking that place. So I think they play a much bigger role in those memorial landscapes, places like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall, or like the newly opened September 11th Memorial, or in Oklahoma City, they actually retained a part of the fence from when they were doing rescue and recovery, and then construction, that people even back then were leaving things on the fence, and they retained that as a part of the memorial along the perimeter. And this is something that is a very powerful experience for people, that often they'll have a hard time recalling, you know, maybe what exactly they saw in the landscape, but they'll remember that, you know, they went and got flowers and left them there, or they had brought some things from friends to leave there, or they left a note on a notebook that was left for people to leave sentiments. And so they remember the activity that they did, but maybe not necessarily some very important symbolic landscape element.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of some of the really powerful examples, for instance, of the dialogue that was generated through forms of graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you know of other ways in which that kind of dialogue can be incorporated more into these formal spaces.
Yes, and there's a sort of an old-fashioned way of doing this, where most places do have some sort of a guest book. It's either a physical guest book, of course, or in the old-fashioned sense, or some sort of technology that allows people to leave comments that then can be in some way seen by others. And Oklahoma City for a while actually had something exactly like that was institutionalized within the museum, and then I talk about it in the book because it's gone now. It's an interesting sort of moment in their history where they had a physical a wall where people could leave messages, and of course it got cleaned every day, but it was one specific room, and you could go in, you could read everything that everyone else had left. It was an appropriate place for marking, and they shifted to a computer kiosk where you can leave your message, but you can no longer see what others have left. So it's a you're participating in building an archive, but it's an archive that no one sees anymore. So there's not that dialogic activity that's actually going on in the space. And I think with the insistence of this sort of marking presence and leaving sentiments is rather important, and there are some very interesting ways that you can institutionalize that within a given institution or within a memorial landscape. The Atocha train station M11 memorials 1-2, where literally it is inscribed inside in the lining of the actual glass cylinder, messages that people had left, although it's static, if there's no additional dialogue that's actually going on there.
In the preface to your book, you mentioned that working at the World Trade Center site was often emotionally difficult. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to share a bit more about some of the challenges that you faced?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was often incredibly difficult, either, you know, in terms of my own sort of experiences in witnessing certain activities, my conversations with tourists or with locals, with survivors, with victims, family members, returned rescue and recovery workers. I think one of the main reasons is that one of the things people would do is they would insist on telling their story. When you would first meet someone at that place, you know, a conversation almost sort of immediately went to, what was your experience that day? And you know, it ranged from very mundane, you know, recollections of going to school or, you know, arriving at work, for people who didn't live in, you know, they were from places far away from New York, to, you know, locals, you know, basically saying, I heard the sound of a plane. And they'll say, and now every time I hear a plane, I look up and I just hope that it's not happening again. And that's a very powerful thing, emotional, both for the teller and for the person hearing this. And for people who suffered losses, you know, that's even greater. And there were times when I would sometimes help, that sometimes the day before, the morning of the anniversaries, so I'd be sort of looking at how the informal spaces were being sort of, if you will, the makeshift shrine moment was becoming even bigger, and people would show up with, you know, boxes of materials for friends or family members who had died, and, you know, basically putting them up on the fence, and would help them, and, you know, be talking to them, and hear their stories and their ongoing loss, you know, that they feel every day. They're triggered by just the tiniest little mundane things. And then, you know, to think of going through, you know, I was there for a number of summers, for months at a time, and going down there every single day. And then during the anniversaries, that becomes sort of concentrated and into a few days. And being down there for, you know, 10 or 11 hours a day, it's very intense. And it takes a lot of sort of self-debriefing almost every single night. And never quite stepping away. And in the book, I think I talk about how I can't, some of these stories I can't tell because I feel like I don't have a license to tell them. I feel like it's not appropriate for me to tell them, and that I can't quite get the right tenor, not in the way that the people who originally told me those stories expressed them to me. And that too is on a very sort of emotional level. So it's hard, and people do question, how do you get through something like this? You know, what happens when you come home? Do you just sort of forget about it for a while? And you don't. You know, I dream these things. It comes in my dreams, and things, whether it's things that I saw in the archive in Oklahoma City, or it's an experience that I had with someone in New York, you know, it comes back to me. I wouldn't say haunts me, because it's a haunting in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that something that you hope to be able to articulate in writing someday, or do you think it's just a realm that is ineffable and uncapturable?
I'm not sure if I'd be able to do it in writing, but I've may be able to attempt it in other forms. And this is one of the reasons why I implement photography as a visual anthropology method, is that when I begin to put together certain collections of my photographs for certain things, I can see some of those stories in those collections, and that I don't necessarily have to articulate them explicitly, that at least for me, they're very implicit in the images. And so thinking about sort of alternate ways that I might be able to articulate some of these stories is something that I would like to look into the future.
So you see perhaps a wider range of possibility through something like curating photographs.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting.
As a matter of fact, I'm thinking right now, we have an art gallery at NDSU in the Memorial Union, and the head curator, Esther Hockett, has started a what she calls a faculty collections exhibit series, and does several faculty per semester, and looking at things in particular that we collect somehow that is related to the research that we do, but could be considered by most people tangential to it, which I think a lot of the sort of creative faculty. You know, the faculties that some of us have are sort of subsumed into, you know, by our scholarly, although I think of the scholarly and creative as being kind of the same. And in my mind, I've been sort of creating a series of photograph collections and the way that they would actually be laid out that I may look to experiment with in the spring in that gallery. So
very interesting. And would you imagine your audience for that kind of curatorial work as being different from your readership of the book?
I definitely think it could be. I think that it would draw probably a broader audience, people who would probably never have any real interest in reading ethnographic research, you know, even if they might have an interest necessarily in the subject matter. I know, for instance, where the union is located, the gallery is located, it gets a lot of traffic from not just faculty, but students and also administrative staff and maintenance staff. And so people who would otherwise never even know that my book exists. So I think that it could have the potential to be something that would reach a wider audience and generate, I think, for them maybe another set of questions that I could then look to attempt to answer in some future research.
I'm wondering if you have been involved at all in any of the community-based organizing or activism around the sites that you study. So I know that you've looked at several different places, but you focus primarily on Oklahoma City and the World Trade Center site. Have you been involved in some of those ongoing debates and activities in a sort of community participant or activist mode, or have you mainly just approached them as an anthropologist?
Those things I've looked at primarily as sort of context, so I haven't really done sort of firsthand investigation or any sort of participation with those units as sort of like, I sort of see them as those are a particular kind of civic organization or institutional set of structures. And I've kind of tried to be on the sort of other side, on knowing what's going on in terms of that, as well as a lot of the formal planning, but kind of not directly looking at that, rather doing what I sort of, at least in New York, I consider sort of the other side of the fence or the other side of the exhibit, right? For the people who are moving through, encountering and experiencing these things that are produced by or shaped by these other sort of civic organizations. And one of the reasons was because originally when I started my research, I was kind of looking at some of that and was a little bit, you know, frustrated because it's hard to break into those groups. Second, there are some other people who have actually done research on that. And one of the things I really wanted to do was think, okay, what is the aspect to this that I can look at that isn't being addressed? And as it ends up, the tourist and visitor aspect was what was not being explicitly addressed. And so I kind of made that my niche, if you will, but not by ignoring the broader context in which all of these things are being sort of produced, being contested. That's in there. It's just not the primary part of my research. So and even when I've had opportunities, I think, to get into some of those groups, I sort of stepped back just to say, well, this takes me in a little bit different direction than what I'm actually looking to do.
What are the main insights that you hope your readers derive from reading your work?
I think one of the main ones is to sort of disrupt this notion that we build these institutions and these landscapes and we do the collections and the curation of exhibits and assume that people just come and that those places themselves don't actually transform through the process of people visiting. That the meanings associated with an importance, historical importance, memory importance, heritage importance associated with those landscapes and institutions are made in part through these acts of visiting. I think talk about the social salience of a memorial landscape. You know, if no one visits, what does it mean, right, in a vacuum? That it is that social interaction and that engagement that continues to make places meaningful, and that those meanings change over time, but they're not static. And even though you could have the same exhibit, the content doesn't change. As contexts change, as your visitors change, the meanings that are sort of socially accorded to that place, to that particular exhibit, do change. And to sort of see visitors as participatory in that sense, which is a little bit different than how we normally use the word participatory, but they're agents in this sort of sense-making. And I think that's what's really sort of critical here. It kind of flies in the face of if you build it, they will come, and you know that's kind of the end of the story. Oftentimes they come even before you build it. And that too sort of drives home the salience, particularly of a landscape that is literally the site of an actual tragedy. It's a part of that sacralizing of that space, of making it historically important. The second would be just to be considering and taking very seriously tourism, without you know romanticizing the tourist, but that as a sociocultural practice, to think about it in ways that allow you to understand how socially productive it actually is for individuals.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being so generous with your time, and I really look forward to your talk tonight.
Yeah, thank you.